Well, first of all, thank you very much, Corrado, for the kind invitation, and everybody else from the program of Comparative Literature and the Arts, and of course also your dean, Douglas Keogh, who I'm sure was instrumental as well in putting this together. So, I am going to speak broadly about Umberto Eco's fiction. I understand that in the course, in the class that you've been offering, three of the novels were read.
Well, they claim to
it, right? Of course you did. I'm sure you all did. But I like to approach that from sort of the angle of the semiotic theory and then move briefly into the novels. So to date, Umberto Eco's fictional work comprises six novels written in more or less regular intervals in the course of the last 30 years. As Rocco as said, it was a hybrid encyclopedic fiction. It's actually one of his definitions. They combine the detective, the mystery, the picaresque, the epistolary, the romance, and the feuilleton, among others, with verbal and visual material of apocryphal and official history to recreate settings, events, personages, and cultural debates from epochs that Eco has often addressed in his scholarly inquiry. So the early and the late Middle Ages in The Name of the Rose and Baudolino, the Baroque in The Island of the Day Before, the long European 19th century in The Prague Cemetery, and the modern period from fascism and World War II to the present in Foucault's Pendulum and The Mysterious Flame of Queen Loana. But despite this novel's dependency upon historical archives from past to very recent times, these are also works that consistently test the reliability of the historical record and the edifice of its representation. Not only do these novels' archives prompt questions of forgery and authenticity, reliability and unreliability, preservation, transmission, and circulation of knowledge, but their narrativization foregrounds questions of will, memories, and forgetting, of competing and mutually debunking representations. In this sense, Eco's fictions fully participate in the crisis of the idealist philosophy of history, with a capital H, that characterizes the work of many post-Nietzschean non-foundational thinkers. With them, Eco shares a non-organicist, non-teleological understanding of historical material processes as sites of fragmentation, gaps, contradictions, and discontinuities, testing epistemological frameworks as well as ontological categories. Yet, while Eco's narrative discourse reflects our culture's weak understanding of historical knowledge, his fictions also raise questions of agency and responsibility, and here I think I'm echoing what you just said, during times of weakened hermeneutics, by enabling readers to follow a wide range of interpretative activities of characters who strive to create meaning out of the continuum of experience that they inhabit. In this sense, the experience of reading Eco's fiction is an activity closely related to everyday life, because, as Eco writes in one of the very few statements, actually, about what does his fiction do, this is from Six Walks in the Fictional Woods, and I quote, "It is through fiction that we adults train our ability to structure our past and present experience and give sense to the immensity of things that happened, are happening, or will happen in the actual world." End of quote. The interpretive paths pursued by Eco's characters can be usefully elucidated by revisiting some of the most crucial aspects of his semiotic inquiry. Since this is an inquiry that develops across several decades and remains ongoing, I will limit my description to some of its most salient traits: the expansion of the structuralist idea of the sign, the code, and the dictionary, in the dynamic concept of abduction, encyclopedia, and unlimited semiosis, the limits placed on definitional expenditures, the location of the referent and of the subject in processes of signification. In the early 1960s, we know that Eco came into contact with structuralism, which through a broad application of Saussurean linguistics provided an explanation for cultural phenomena understood as sign systems, that these closed and regulated synchronic structures acquire meaning through differential relationships. While Eco encounters with structuralism is well documented in some of his readings of popular culture, for example, the 007 pieces, you know, from the Ian Fleming's novel, with the publication of a work that is actually never allowed to be translated in its entirety, and that's called The Absent Structure, La Struttura Assente, in 1968, Eco begins to question some of the fundamental premises of structuralism, on the ground that its understanding of the sign as a twofold entity of signifier and signified, and of the code as a closed and regulated system, strives to establish constant and absolutes in the phenomena of culture, thus promoting what is essentially a method of inquiry into an ontological category. He actually calls this the structure as the Ur code in a reading of Lévi-Strauss, which is actually quite similar to what Derrida also does at some point. I think it's a piece in Writing and Difference. But besides questioning the ontology of the structure, Eco also advances other, more dynamic approaches to signs, which he describes as, and I quote, the sign of becoming as opposed to that of permanence, a structure that questions itself and sees itself as a historical phenomenon. Eco's statements cannot fail to bring to mind theoreticians such as Derrida, as well as Lacan, who by the mid-60s were actually displacing the centrality of structuralism in the theoretical debate. Nevertheless, despite the fact that La Struttura Assente explicitly refers to the works of this theorist, Eco does not fully abandon the notion of structure. In a gesture that reconciles, and perhaps you know, the tradition of Italian historical materialism comes really into play here, but in a gesture that reconciles materialism with structuralism, he emphasizes the provisionality and therefore the historicity of structures, but maintains their validity in the formalization of the object of inquiry that is necessary to enable cultural, social, and ultimately political change. At some point he calls this the semiological guerrilla warfare. You need to be able to describe something in order to question something. Any tensions inherent in Eco's attempt to negotiate the poles of formalization and processuality, synchronic and diachronic analysis, are resolved in his argument that what is at stake is less an irreducible opposition and more an issue of how closure and openness ultimately imply and legitimate each other. Eco's productive, if tense, dialogue with structuralism brings us to the threshold of his monumental reflection on signs, which he will pursue throughout the 1970s and 80s with five major works. And those works were The Form of Content, The Sign, A Theory of Semiotics, The Sign of Three, and Semiotics and the Philosophy of Language. Collectively considered, these works combine the structural insight of Saussure, but also Jemelsleff and Jacobson, with more dynamic notions of the sign proposed by Morris and especially the American pragmatist Peirce. The result is a systematization of semiotics as a discipline, a science of sign conceived as a theory of codes and a theory of sign production. The first, or the theory of code, entails a semiotic of signification, a code-based semiotics focused on the rules underlying and governing the functioning of a great variety of natural and artificial languages understood as closed system. And therefore, they can encompass, you know, olfactory signs or semiotics, tactile communication, but also musical, aesthetic, visual codes, and so on. By contrast, in theorizing about the semiotic of communication, that is, in exploring how new meanings are produced, Eco replaces the Saussurean notion of the sign as a twofold entity of signifier and signified with that of the sign function, which is a mutable and transitory correlation between one or more units of expression that can be associated with one or more semantic units of content. Furthermore, Eco describes the production of meaning as an inferential process depended not upon two, but upon three entities: the sign, the object, and that for which the sign stands for, which would be its interpretant, or the material effect created by the relation between sign and object. Therefore, the meaning of a sign, or its interpretant, comes to reside in another sign, in a process of unlimited semiosis produced in the shift from interpretant to interpretant. Eco's inferential definition of the sign also enables a departure from dictionary-like semantics of structuralist derivation, or semantic based upon a one-to-one equivalence, and leads to the development of a very important concept, the concept of the encyclopedia, the labyrinthine archive of culture, which he calls the rhizome. And of course, here, Deleuze and Guattari, the rhizome is very important as a background to this concept. And I quote from Eco: "The universe of semiosis, that is, the universe of human culture, is structured according to a network of interpretants. It is virtually infinite, because it takes into account multiple interpretations realized by different cultures. It does not register only truths, but rather what has been said about the truth, or what has been believed to be true, as well as what has been believed to be false or imaginary." End of quote. The new semantic model that the encyclopedia represents is mobilized through a process of abduction. That is, conjectures and hypotheses that proceed through a series of possible inferences, giving rise to an infinite number of associations enabled by the units of the encyclopedia during the course of interpretation. But Eco's dynamic notion of the sign cannot be compared to that which informs theories of pragmatism, radical reader response, and deconstruction. The regress enabled by the inferential process of abduction through the meandering open paths of the encyclopedia does not produce the undecidability of the deconstructive drift of Derrida, or maybe more, the followers of Derrida, or the endless slippage of meaning along the chain of signification of desire, that's Lacan. Not only does abduction remain teleologically oriented towards the creation of a more developed and better determined sign, but its potential for unbounding drift is contained by the notion of ground, or context, and final interpretant, or position or provisional definitions agreed upon by the habit, that is, the intersubjective agreement of interpretative communities negotiated at a given historical, social, and cultural moment. And I think, again, this came up in the previous presentation. Excuse me. This regulative aspect of eco-semiotics, semiotic inquiry also informs three of his major works on reception and hermeneutics from the late 70s to the 90s: The Role of the Reader, The Limits of Interpretation, and Interpretation and Over-Interpretation. Without proposing a belated notion of univocal, absolute meaning, The Role of the Reader makes a case for the importance of textual and contextual boundaries to regulate the process of interpreting signs. From the premise that acts of interpretation depend upon the reader's willingness to cooperate with the message as opposed to using the message, Eco contends that the reader's hypothesis must be validated by the text and its context, and therefore accepted only if legitimate and discarded as misreadings when proven invalid. Likewise, the limits of interpretation and over-interpretation argue for the importance of rational logic, so principles of linearity, causality, non-contradiction, and the excluded middle, the Aristotelian principles, to guide decoding, while stressing once again fidelity to text and context, and the role of interpretative communities to arrest the potentially unlimited processes of inference that is enabled by the encyclopedia, which is infinite. It should be noted that within this extensive reflection on signs, as it develops from the 60s to the 90s, Eco makes no claim for the referentiality of semiotics, but establishes boundaries and demarcating lines to exclude non-semiotic territories. Among these territories are the reference, or objects, things, or states of the world, and the acting, concrete, biological, human subject of the semiotic process. And this is probably what really distinguishes him from attempts in France, for example, by Julia Christel, right, who tried to breach Lacan as well, psychoanalysis with semiotic. In Eco's view, subjects and reference are inscribed within the inferential mobility of the sign, destined to emerge only as express contents of semiotic processes. They might have arisen from bodily and sensorial apparati, such as the body's perception, but whose being can only be revealed through signs. Ecosemiotics and the philosophy of language forcefully restates the irreferentiality of his semiotic theory, since the subject is said once again to emerge as a diffuse, mobile configuration through processes of sign production and interpretation. And I quote from Eco, "As subjects, we are what the shape of the world produced by signs makes us become. We recognize ourselves only as semiosis in progress, signifying systems and communicational processes." End of quote. Eco's understanding of the referent and the subject is inscribed in and coinciding with signifying processes extends beyond the theory of semiotics and the philosophy of language to permeate by necessity his theory of reception and interpretation, where authors and readers are not empirical subjects but model authors and model readers, manifested in the creation and actualization of textual structures, respectively. That is, in the codes, subcodes, fabulae, frames, topics, ideologies, and so on, that constitute the text, and they will be revealed in processes of sign decoding. And actually, I'm quote what was just quoted. echoes, I suppose. The empirical reader is only an actor who makes conjectures about the kind of model reader postulated by the text. The initiative of the model reader consists in figuring out a model author that is not the empirical one. End of quote. In Kant and the Platypus, which is probably, I would say, the last of Eco's major theoretical works, of course, he has published a lot more since his book came out in 1997 in Italian, but I think this is probably the, you know, theoretical terms, you know, as far as we have so far. Eco addresses more closely the non-semiotic territories excluding from his earlier reflection on signs and explores the connections between objects and the representation, reality and text, by revisiting one of Peirce's notions, the notion of dynamical object. That is the starting point of cognition, that through perceptual judgment creates the immediate object, or the object as it is represented by the sign. So there's something out there that elicits the semiotic process. One of these dynamical objects was the platypus, which is actually in the title of the book, as a terminus aquam of signification, a being so strange that it aroused many processes of semiosis because nobody knew how to classify it. It does many different things and it belongs to many different categories, or what we thought were the categories. Nevertheless, in this work also, Eco maintains firm his conviction that being can only be known through language and that perception and knowledge are mediated by processes of semiosis, that is, by the signs of our cultural schemata. In summary, then, from the late 60s onwards, Eco's reflection on sign has evolved from a semiotic of decodification founded upon a static notion of sign as equivalence and a dictionary-like semantics of structuralist derivation to one of interpretation, where the sign is conceptualized as a dynamic process of inferential abductions enabled by the ever-expanding encyclopedia. Nevertheless, if signifying processes depend upon the unlimited semiosis enabled by the encyclopedia, Eco's work also restrained definitional expenditures by way of habit, ground, and final interpretant. Against the background of these important developments in Eco's theoretical inquiry, what has remained perhaps constant is his culturalist, non-referential understanding of semiotics as the theory of subject, object, things, of state, as of the world as expressed contents, from which we can nevertheless derive a conjectural but also provisional notion of truth and of consensual reality, what we all agree to take as reality. The extensive reflection on the mechanism and dynamics of sign production and interpretation of eco-semiotic inquiry resonates throughout his fictional works. However, it is important to clarify that this relationship is not simply one of specular reflection. While his novels are infused by semiotic theories, they're also creative endeavors informed by the poetics of Eco's open work, the famed, you know, Opera Aperta, really the book that launched Eco. For this reason, Eco's novel cannot simply be read as roman à thèse, that is, as the expression of a semiotician who, on the weekend, seeks to persuade his readers of the validity of the inquiries that he has pursued in his scholarly work. Embracing his own dictum, that modern and contemporary works embody the poetics of the open work, Eco creates multicoded, plurivocal texts that allow for a number of possible interpretations. And I quote from Eco, "When I write a theoretical text, I try to reach, from a disconnected lump of experiences, a coherent conclusion, and I propose this conclusion to my readers. When I write a novel, on the contrary, even though starting probably from the same lump of experiences, I realize that I'm not trying to impose a conclusion. I stage a play of contradiction. It is not that I do not impose a conclusion because there is no conclusion. On the contrary, there are many possible conclusions, frequently each of them being impersonated by one or more different characters. I refrain from imposing a choice between them, not because I do not want to choose, but because the task of the creative text is to display the contradictory plurality of its conclusion, setting the reader free to choose. In this sense, the creative text is always an open work." End of quote. Eco's fictions then share numerous affinities with the cluster of contemporary historical novels examined by Linda Hutcheon in a study of post-World War II narrative, A Poetics of Postmodernism. According to Hutcheon, fictions such as Rushdie, Midnight Children, or Swift Waterland belong to the genre of historiographic metafiction, a type of self-reflexive historical novel that doesn't advance a correct model of reading and interpreting the world that would be comparable to that of the roman à thèse, but relies instead of a number of hypothetical discursive practices that are more typical of the roman à thèse. In Hutcheon's words, historiographic metafictions do not seek, through the vehicle of fiction, to persuade the readers of the correctness of a particular way of interpreting the world. Instead, they make the readers question their own, and by implication, others' interpretation. They're more roman à hypothèse than roman à thèse. Turning down to Eco's fiction, let's begin with the paratextual apparatus surrounding The Name of the Rose. This historical novel was hailed by critics as one of the first actually examples of the postmodern literature in Italy. Just 2 years later, Eco sort of implicitly acknowledged that perhaps this was the case, because he wrote a postscript to The Name of the Rose, and also released a long interview with Stefano Rosso where he addresses postmodernism. In both texts, Eco approaches postmodernism from aesthetic categories, that is, as a poetics of excitation, replay of existing form, genre, and so on, as metafiction. But also argues that it is a meta-historical, philosophical category, not delimited by the after or the post of 20th century modernity, but emerging, and I quote, "whenever it is discovered that the world has no fixed centers, that I have to find my way through the world, inventing my own points of reference." Actually concludes with human, all too human, if I'm not mistaken. The figure that illustrates this cognitive space is, for Eco, the labyrinthine rhizome, which is nothing but the model of culture that he had theorized in his semiotic inquiry as the encyclopedia. A mobile and unstable cognitive space that is potentially infinite and never structured because it is constantly shaped and reshaped by the inclusion of new, often contradictory cultural units. And it is precisely a narrative rendition of these cognitive spaces that provide the background and setting of Eco Six novels. The microcosm of The Name of the Rose is a medieval Latin world destabilized by the conflict between church and empire, two popes, and the strife between two monarchs. Traditional forms of knowledge and institutions that derive from them are cast into doubt by the rise of heretical movements, the emergence of a secular culture, and the rediscovery of Aristotelian rationality. The instability of the fictional world at large is reflected by the events that befall upon the Benedictine Abbey in 1327, when the abbey's monastic order is broken by the mysterious death of the monks, of some of the monks. Eco's second novel on the Middle Ages, Baudolino, represents a world divided by competing political and social ideologies. The communes of northern Italy, more and more oriented towards a mercantile economy, seeks to sever their feudal tie with Barbarossa, whose imperial claim led Pope Alexander III to excommunicate him and support the commune's quest for civic autonomy. Italy becomes a stage of wars, as Barbarossa crosses the Alps several times. The complexity of this political configuration increases with the Fourth Crusade, when, following 3 days of pillaging and plundering, Constantinople falls at the end of none other than Christian, Venetian, and Crusaders in 204. The conquest of Constantinople and the colonization of the Byzantine Empire by the West is realized, at the price, however, of immeasurable harm to future relationships between Eastern and Western cultures. The instability that characterizes the world of the Rose and Baudolino permeates the rest of Eco's novels, regardless of their chronological settings. The Island of the Day Before takes place in the 17th century, a period of enormous religious, social, and philosophical transformation. We have the Reformation, the non-edit, the discovery of the new world, that lead to a crumbling of inherited theological systems. The Copernican Revolution and the experiments of Galileo Galilei probe the adequacy of scientific models, of previous scientific models, while pre-Socratic and Lucretian philosophies are rising and clashing with Aristotelian substantiality and scholastic metaphysics. Political and social instability is just as strong, and with the 30-year war begins a period of alternating hegemonies of French, British, and Spanish powers. Moving on to the 20th century, the main events of Foucault's pendulum occur between the 70s and the 80s, and therefore after the Cultural Revolution of 68, in a world fragmented by semi-autonomous social, political, and cultural beliefs. The mysterious flame of Queen Loana narrates the story of Giambattista Bodoni, Yambo, who, after having suffered a possible stroke on April 1991, cannot recognize friends and family and has no understanding of his past self as a young man raised during the years of the fascist totalitarianism. As for Eco's latest novel, The Prague Cemetery, this is a work that reconstructs through the travels of Simonini between Turin, Naples, and Paris a vast historical fresco shaken by the French Revolution and the Paris Commune, Freemasonry, clericalism, anti-clericalism, capitalism, and industrial revolution, but especially the unfolding of nationalisms and anti-Semitism. Yet it is precisely from such mobile cognitive spaces that is born the vis semiotica of Eco's characters, who produce chains upon chains of signs as they amass and interpret information to create ordering patterns from the complex, contradictory words of their fictional experience. In The Name of the Rose, William of Baskerville investigates a series of murders that have occurred in the Benedictine monastery. In Foucault's Pendulum, the young scholar Casaubon, from his hiding place at the Conservatoire in Paris on June 23, 1984, reconstructs the event of a 14-year period that led him, along with his friends Belbo and Diotallevi, to the creation of the Knights Templars' plan for the conquest of the world. The experience of the 30-year war leads the 17th century protagonist of the island of the day before, Roberto dei Pozzi, into a series of conjectures to identify good and bad armies, villains and heroes, victors and vanquished. Roberto's conjectures are to know further developments when he shipwrecks at the Antipodes, where he discovers that the signs that his language, his Western language system, has provided him with are not only inadequate to describe an ever-evolving European culture, but are completely ineffective in relation to the flora and fauna of the new world that surrounds him. He's never seen a kangaroo, for example, or a palm tree, so he has to resort to metaphors. The vis semiotica exemplified by William Casaubon and Roberto dei Pozzi is shared by virtually all of the characters of Eco's novels, including Baudolino, the protagonist of the homonymous novel, and Simonini from the Prague's Cemetery. These are characters who provide explanations for events and facts that are taken or have been taken as factual truths by the Encyclopedia of Culture, but also for the legends and myths that the Encyclopedia records, for the forgeries and lies that often have been taken as truth and have therefore become the cause of factual, historically recorded events and occurrences. But Eco's narratives do not simply exemplify, for this reader anyway, the birth of semiotic creativity in the rhizomatic labyrinth of the encyclopedic archive, but through character-led plots chart a wide range of hypothetical models of semiotic production. From the first episode of The Name of the Rose, William, armed with the teaching of Aristotle, Bacon, and Occam, displays a mastery of logical methods of inductive and deductive reasoning based upon empirical observations that enable him to recognize with accuracy the marks left on the snow by an unknown animal, but also name with accuracy that animal, and it's the famous horse Brunellus, right? It's one of the great episodes of the novel. William's ability to interpret signs extends beyond induction and deduction to encompass the conjectural model of abduction, so the hypothetical. As he explains, and I quote, "Solving a mystery means lining up so many disjointed elements and venturesome hypotheses," end of quote. William's semiotic virtuosity is pitted against that of Azzo, Bernard de Guy, and Jorge of Burgos, refusing to acknowledge the unlimited interpretability that the ever-changing world of the encyclopedia requires. These are characters whose conjectures do not depend upon the inferences and hypotheses enabled by an open order of meaning by the encyclopedia, but tend towards the affirmation of dictionary-like definitions, like the structuralists, and the preservation of closed structures and center universes guaranteed by a divine order. You know, the center, the Ur structure. But if in the Rose, the death of Jorge and the burning of the library represent the demise of closed order of meanings and of their defenders, the novel also reveals the limits of William's conjectures. While the books of the greatest library of the medieval Christian world are turning to parchments in the dramatic fire of the seventh day, William must admit the fallibility of his vis semiotica that had posited the existence of an order in the universe based on the correspondence between signs and things, on the adequatio rei and intellectus, instead of recognizing the provisional and contingent value of every instrument of human knowledge. And I quote from, William, "The order that our mind imagines is like a net, or like a ladder, built to attain something. But afterwards, you must throw the ladder away, because you discover that, even if it was useful, it was meaningless." End of quote. And of course, the story itself, right? I mean, the way it gets to the murders, it invalidates the semiotic process. Yet the interpretive debacle of William and his realization that the orders created by the mind are provisional and contingent neither sanctions the closed hermeneutic models of Bernard de Guy and Jorge, nor the hermeneutic drift. As the events that befall upon the characters of Foucault's Pendulum suggest, skepticism towards absolute orders and truths does not imply cognitive relativism. Conspiracy theorists, the characters of Foucault's Pendulum have sought nothing less than to reconstruct the Knight Templar's plan for the conquest of the world through the harnessing of telluric energy on the basis of a text found in a library. With the help of a computer named Abulafia, Belbo Casaubon and Diota Levi have reconstructed the plan up to 1944. But they've done so by way of a conspiratorial narrative that associates Hitler to the Argonauts, Marx and Freud to the Red Brigades, Jules Verne and Trithemius to Richelieu, the Milky Way to the Golden Fleece, Bacon and Shakespeare to the Freemasons and the Jesuits, and so much more. But alongside their interpretation is also a reading of the secret message as a simple laundry list of a merchant that is provided by Leah, Casaubon's girlfriend. When faced with this reading, Casaubon proves unable to abandon his interpretive practices and will only do so after his friend Belbo is killed by the Diabolicals. The novel, in fact, ends with his declaration that he has finally understood, that there is nothing to understand. Nevertheless, since Casaubon is aware that even his silence will become the object of aberrant interpretations, nothing remains for him to do but engage in a sort of post-semiotic contemplation of the horizon that lies ahead of him. And I quote, "So I might as well stay here, wait, and look at the hill. It's so beautiful." End of quote. Like most of the characters from Foucault's Pendulum, the main protagonist of Eco's third novel, The Island of the Day Before, also exemplifies an aberrant interpretative model, a practice of hermeneutic semiosis that brings Roberto to establish connections that reproduce some of the hermeneutic practices discussed by Eco in The Limits of Interpretation and Interpretation and Overinterpretation. In an unrestrained use of interpretants that not only disregards rules of causality, non-contradiction, excluded middle, and so on, but depends upon a highly flexible system of analogies and similarities, Roberto immerses himself more and more in the drift of signification. This drift eventually leads him to cross ontological boundaries and enter the water of the Pacific Ocean, convinced that he will either traverse the line of the 180th meridian, that is the dateline, allowing him to come back to the past, to the day before, and thus save his beloved Lilia, or that, alternatively, his body will be dissolved in atoms of air that will reach the beloved woman in a fatal, eternal embrace. Even though the bisemiotic of Yambo, the character of the mysterious flame of Queen Loana, is not an example of agnostic and hermetic semiosis comparable to that of the characters of the Pendulum and the Island, his interpretation also achieved problematic results. In a quest for his lost identity after losing his autobiographical memory, Yambo goes to the family house in the countryside of Solara, where he seeks to recover his eye through the semantic memory of the encyclopedia of the culture of his childhood and youth. Books, films, songs, cartoons, photographs, and objects that belong for the most part to the second half of the fascist ventennio. Through this text, Yambo manages to reconstruct a considerable portion of the culture of the times, a popular mass culture version of the library of the Name of the Rose. In this process of anamnesis, however, is also expressed eco-understanding of the subject as a subjectivity in process, a mobile configuration that emerges in the production and interpretation of signs. The Yambo partially achieves in the inferences of his semiotic performances, but does not recognize as being subject-producing. Not surprisingly, the novel closes with the deferred plenitude of the self. Yambo, who thinks that he has identified his true I with the face of a lost love of youth, Lilia, awaits eagerly for her appearance among the parade of characters, most of them belonging to cartoons and youth literature, that descend the stairway at the end of the novel. Yet Lilia's face remains hidden in the foggy smoke of the room, and in the darkness that descends upon Yambo, who is either dying or entering into another coma. If the bisemiotic of the main characters of The Rose, The Pendulum, The Island, and The Mysterious Flame often leads to failed or at least problematic results, The rose ends in a big fire. The pendulum and the island leave readers uncertain over the final destiny of the main protagonist. The flame ends without Iambo's discovery of his eye. The impact of their conjectures is nevertheless limited to themselves or to the immediate groups of characters that surround them. Different, however, are the cases of Baudolino and Simonini, whose processes of symbolization become engines of history. Baudolino, moved by his desire, illogical reason, and even the fact, probably some drug, right, his green honey that keeps coming up in the novel, produces a large number of forgeries that the encyclopedia registers as truth, thereby causing events that have impacted the real world. Baudolino engenders the Constitutio Habita, which was the granting of Frederick of special privileges for the law scholars in Bologna, the canonization of Charlemagne in 1165 in Aachen. He also creates relics, myths, legends, such as the one of the Holy Grail, the history of the foundation of the city of Alexandria, the love poems of Abelard to Eloise, but especially the famous letter of Prester John. This 12th century letter described the Prester as an Extorian who led a kingdom full of riches. In this marvelous, fantastic world, rivers contain precious stones, the earth was populated by elephants, camels, hippopotami, and dromedaries, but also by imaginary beings identified as the marvelous, monstrous races since antiquity, but revived in the Middle Ages by authors such as Isidore de Seville, for example, and especially the book of John Mandeville. Yet, the Prester's kingdom doesn't only illustrate the medieval world of the marvelous grotesque and the fantastic, but also an alternative moral geography. As Baudolino notes, this land has been the refuge over the centuries of all the sects excluded from the Christian world, including the 10 lost tribes of Israel. Here, every pilgrim was welcomed with charity. No one was poor. There were no thieves, predators, miserers, or flatterers. This is also a space where the various races, and we have centaurs, horned men, fauns, satyrs, pygmy, cynocephali, one-eyed man, and of course, you know, the Ipazia. All these various races give no importance to bodily differences, to color and shape as we do, when even if we see a dwarf, we consider him a horror of nature. In this sense, the conjectures of Baudolino well exemplify a fictional utopia. As the Prester kingdom is a land of tolerance and syncretism, in part, and a haven for ideas banned in the West, from the West. Nevertheless, since the letter describes Prester John as a descendant of the three Magi, as well as an ally of the Christians against the Muslims and the Patriarch of Constantinople, this was also a piece of writing that could, and in fact did, legitimate projects of Western expansion towards Africa and Asia. And of course, the Crusades are part of this program. In short, Baudolino conjectures perform the alternative order of a medieval fantastic utopia, but also the darker side of fakes. This might explain the reason why, at the end of the novel, Baudolino, guilty of many deaths, including that of his adoptive father, Frederick, climbs the white stone column of the hermits, promising never to produce sign again. In yet another post-semiotic moment, they cannot but bring to mind the closing words of Azzo of Melk from The Rose. And I quote from Baudolino, "I will try to achieve a solitary distance from every opinion and imagination. I will drain my soul and intellect. I will arrive beyond the kingdom of the mind." End of quote. To be sure, after a few seasons spent on top of the column, Baudolino gets down and leaves for the lands of Prester John, newly captive of a fantasy so strong to move his own reality. But the episode remains an admission of the limits of his conjectures nevertheless, as fascinating and as enthralling as some might be, not just for the possible world of the character, but also for that of the readers of Eco's novel. And I think he actually had dedicated his novel to his grandson. Is that true, Rock? I think so, right? Baudolino, yes. And it's the only one, because it's a delightful work, I think, you know. This world of magic and... If despite the effects of forgeries on reality, lengths such as the kingdom of Prester John contain an apology for the science of fantasy, or at least for the utopian aspects of marvelous conjecture, different is the case of the Prague Cemetery. As in Baudolino, in this novel also, Echo places at the center of the narrative the creation of a forgery. But the story is no longer that of a pleasant boy named Baudolino, but of Simonini, the nephew of a reactionary Piedmontese captain who ever since childhood has nurtured in him sentiments of hate for the other. Such hate transforms Simonini into a monster, a character that is undeniably the most sinister of all of Echo's entire corpus. Exiled to France during the Italian Risorgimento, Simonini becomes a professional forger and creates documents against the Jesuits, the Freemasons, and especially the Jews. Through the grafting of many existing texts by Joly, Gioberti, Dumas, it's the entire anti-Semitic tradition of Europe, and the perfidiousness of his semiotic conjectures, Simonini not only fuels myths of Freemasons and Jesuits conspiracy, but leads to the anti-Semitism of the Dreyfus case, and especially to the protocols of the Elders of Zion. A 19th century text that functioned as a vessel to house not only Christian prejudice towards the Jews, but also the anxiety caused by the advent of European modernity, secularism, socialism, internationalism, universal education, women's suffrage, and so on. The protocol sought to demonstrate a Jewish conspiracy to take over the world. And even though this semiotic process was a forgery created by a sinister criminal mind, it had the power to provide a totalizing explanation for the complexity of an emerging European modernity, a narrative that was unfortunately easy to believe by minds too weak to confront a reality transformed by modernity and too eager to find the comfort of assuring truth. In the world of factual history, the protocols were sold to the Tsar, disseminated under the titles of the Great Within the Small, by Sergei Nilus. Immediately translated in numerous languages, the reliability of the protocols was negated in 1921. The year it was denounced as a false by the Times. Yet the power of the text continued to inspire racial hatred, thus providing a justification for projects of exterminations that might have played a part in the horrors of Nazism and sadly even further, thus becoming, and I quote, the most widely circulated work in the world after the Bible, end of quote. As reported by a chronological table added by Echo at the end of the cemetery. A forgery then with catastrophic outcomes upon history, a sign production that is devoid of any utopian redemption on the part of a character who, unlike many other figures that inhabit Echo's fictional oeuvre, doesn't promote any kind of identification with the reader, but even renders the act of reading the endless semiotic deliriums of his first-person narration at times a difficult, uncomfortable process. While these aspects of the novel explain the great deal of controversy that it has generated, the reader can nevertheless follow the interpretation of a hateful, fanatic, and diabolical mind and gain further awareness of the effects of aberrant processes of semiosis on a reality too permeable to fictions and forgeries. In this sense, then, this novel fulfills once again a role that is similar to that of Echo's other fictions. Reflecting on the permeability of reality to fakes and forgeries year before the publication of the Prague Cemetery, in Six Walks in the Fictional Woods, Echo discussed the protocols at some length before asking the following question. And I quote, "How should we deal with intrusion of fiction into life, now that we have seen the historical impact that this phenomenon can have?" End of quote. He then proceeds to note that he doesn't wish to propose that walks in the fictional woods are a remedy for the great tragedies of our time. And I quote, "To understand, they're not a remedy for the great tragedies of our time, but more modestly, that these walks could enable us, as writers and readers, and I quote, to understand the mechanism by which fiction can shape life, and to reflect on how these complex relationships between reader and story, fiction and life, can constitute a form of therapy against the sleep of reason, which generates monsters. In conclusion, then, ecosemiotic theory resonates throughout his fictional works. In a corpus of historiographic metafiction that enacts the hermeneutic successes and failures, the gains and losses of characters who, through interpretation and production of signs, strive to make sense of the complexity of their culture and their circumstances. The Name of the Rose illustrates the limits of totalizing interpretations, as well as the provisional and contingent nature of cognitive schemata that claim to order, once and for all, the labyrinth of the world. Foucault's pendulum explores hermetic drift and pragmatic restraint, while The Island of the Day Before describes the pitfalls of unlimited semiosis, but also the creativity of metaphors that arise from the unknown objects of perceptual cognition. The mysterious flame of Queen Loana represents the inferential location of the subject at the confluence of a shared and individual encyclopedia, while Baudolino and the Prague Cemetery illustrate how fictional signs, even though misguided, fake, have the power to affect the world of history and reality. Ultimately, then, in the play of contradiction between the many interpretive models that arise from a meta-historical postmodern condition, from the Name of the Rose to the Prague Cemetery, ecosemiotic imaginary enables readers to follow the conjectural cartographies of possible worlds and evaluate the viability of models of sign production and decoding, of the cognitive instruments that we might employ to navigate responsibly the undeniable complexity of the historical, cultural, and social processes that constitute the lived experience of every human experience. Thank you.